On Monday, state lawmakers passed legislation designed to ensure that New Yorkers who have suffered financially due to the pandemic will be safe from any evictions or foreclosures through May 1st. The relief package also pauses ongoing eviction proceedings for 60 days, provides support for small landlords, and guarantees the continuation of certain property tax breaks. For more on the measure, we spoke Monday afternoon to the bill's sponsor, Manhattan Democrat Brian Kavanaugh, chair of the chamber's Housing, Construction, and Community Development Committee. So, Senator, can you explain sort of the eviction and foreclosure protections in this measure and sort of put it into context how they compare to, I guess, the existing federal and state protections that I guess this is going to supersede, really?
Right. So we had an eviction moratorium and some similar restrictions on foreclosures in place in New York for much of the pandemic since March of 2020. But the blanket moratorium on evictions in New York State effectively expired on September 30th. It was a combination of executive orders and administrative orders of the courts. There has been an executive order in place since then that put some restrictions on filings and on evictions going forward, but we did begin to see significant numbers of evictions happening, and it seemed to be that in many cases they were happening in cases where there seemed to be some hardship that the tenant was experiencing, and they were nonetheless being evicted. And we expected that to accelerate. We expected as the courts became more functional, there were going to be more and more evictions all over the state. So what we're doing now is passing a bill that says if you are having a hardship, whether you be a tenant who is threatened with eviction or a homeowner threatened with foreclosure or a small landlord threatened with foreclosure, and in the context of foreclosure, we're talking about tax foreclosure or mortgage foreclosure, you can sign a declaration of hardship that lays out the various ways one might be experiencing hardship right now. And if you sign that, you are basically protected from eviction or foreclosure until May 1st.
Is there any sort of threshold for what qualifies as a hardship? Is it if I've lost my job? Is it if I'm afraid of going outside and there might be health risks and thus I can't do my job? Where do you guys set the bar?
There is the legislation actually creates the specific form that tenants and landlords and homeowners who would be seeking protection would have to sign. And it basically says, with respect to tenants, there are two different kinds of hardship. There is financial hardship, and that has to result, that has to be such that you're signing a statement that says you cannot pay your rent in full because of a financial hardship. The financial hardship could be a reduction in income. It could be an increase in expenses resulting from additional child care or taking care of a sick relative that is related to COVID. Or it could be increased out-of-pocket expenses as a result of having to do your essential work. And it also could be that you were attesting that it would be a hardship for you to move given the expenses of moving and given the pandemic. There's an additional kind of hardship, which is that your health would be affected. If you are over 65 or you have a medical condition that would make you particularly susceptible to COVID or you have a disability that would make you particularly susceptible, you can say that it would be a hardship for you to displace from your home, and you would also get the protection in that case. So there is specific language. There are not dollar figures or specific thresholds that you'd have to check boxes on because different people are going to experience hardship in a different way. There's, you know, wide range of different economic conditions in the state, different levels of rent, different levels of income. But you would be attesting under penalty of law that you are experiencing hardship and that hardship is preventing you from paying your rent or causing a serious health risk to you.
And why did you decide to take that approach instead of doing some sort of, I guess, means testing or some way of creating thresholds? Why did you do the approach you guys went with?
I think it's important to recognize that we have a very large number of households that are experiencing hardship in the state. We think that there are somewhere between 800,000 and 1.2 million household renter households that are behind on their rent out of a total number of rental houses in the state of 4.1 million. So it's a good fraction of all renters. There are similar figures. The data on homeowners is less reliable, but we think it's, you know, a comparable percentage of homeowners that are struggling. So any process that tries to either apply a single rule, like the Republicans in the Senate proposed that we say if you're making more than $99,000 as a single income household, you are not qualified for any of the relief that we're talking about. We thought that kind of blanket rule would screen out some people that are experiencing a genuine hardship. We don't want people to get evicted simply because their rent is a little higher and their income is a little higher than some other people. So these protections are not just for low-income people. They're for middle-class people, working people. And we wanted to make sure that the attestation is something that people can sign readily. So, for example, the California version of the attestation, you're not permitted to get the benefit unless you are paying 25% of your rent. That would leave out the people with the most hardship. The people who have lost all of their income and are just not even able to pay 25%. The federal CDC attestation has a requirement that you attest that you have exhausted all possible public benefits. That is a very difficult thing for an ordinary person to attest to, that they've thoroughly researched all the possible benefits they might get and exhausted them. So this attestation is serious. It is targeted at people who are experiencing a real hardship, but it is intended to be something that if somebody is experiencing hardship, they can sign it and they can get the protections.
Once the governor does sign this bill, how do you anticipate New Yorkers will learn about the relief measure? For instance, how do they become aware of this standardized hardship declaration form?
So the first thing the bill does is create a 60-day stay on all proceedings. No proceeding can go forward in eviction or foreclosure for 60 days. That is intended to be a period during which people can become aware of their rights and the courts can adopt the new practices that will be necessary. The Office of Court Administration is required to translate the form into 7 languages and post the English version and the 7 translations on their website within 15 days of the date the bill becomes law. They are required to provide a copy of the form to any respondent in a pending case who might benefit from it. And any landlord who wants to file a subsequent case or any entity, a bank or a taxing authority that wants to foreclose would have to provide a copy of the form to the respondent in that case, and they would have to, in order to file a case, they'd have to have file an affidavit with the proceeding, with the papers for the case to say they have served this on the respondent and the respondent has not signed it and returned it. Otherwise, the case cannot start. So we've got various mechanisms by which people can find out about it. Obviously, we as public officials will also be spreading the word. You know, the news media have an important role in this. So we hope that by 60 days from now, there will be a widespread understanding that this process exists and that if you have a hardship, you have a way out of being displaced from your home.
Once this becomes law, what does it mean for tenants who haven't suffered financially or might act in a manner that would generally warrant an eviction? Is there a way for landlords to begin eviction proceedings for those people?
There are exceptions in the bill for people who are persistently engaging in behavior that is either causing a health or safety threat or that is restricting the ability of other people who live in the building to enjoy their own apartments. Sometimes that's called a nuisance. Mm-hmm. The bill has it's a somewhat narrow version of nuisance. Often nuisance cases might involve accusations of violations of leases that are not really causing any harm to anybody. So the bill creates a somewhat narrower version of that, but it still allows those cases to go forward, even in the case where the tenant is attesting to a hardship. There would have to be a hearing to determine that behavior is happening. And if a judge determines that there is such behavior, the eviction can proceed. For other folks, if you are not able to attest that you have a hardship, that means you have an ability to pay your rent. And, you know, I said this in a number of contexts, but an eviction moratorium is not a rent holiday. If you have an ability to pay your rent, it is in your interest to continue to pay your rent, and there will be consequences for people who willfully choose not to pay rent.
Can you talk about what this legislation means for relatively small landlords, which the measure defines as people who own 10 or fewer dwelling units?
Yeah, the bill recognizes that landlords are also suffering hardship. And for small landlords, again, if you have 10 or fewer units, you can sign a hardship declaration that is similar to the one that tenants are being offered. It has the additional condition of hardship, which is my tenants are not paying their rent in significant amounts. And that is that results in a hardship. And in that case, you are protected from mortgage foreclosure and tax foreclosure and a tax lien sale of your property. And all of those things would be halted until May 1st in the same way that we're halting eviction proceedings until May 1st.
And why did you choose a threshold there of 10 or fewer? I mean, theoretically, someone who has 11, they might consider them a small landlord. That's how they might see themselves.
I'm reminded of the movie Spinal Tap, which made a lot of the difference between 10 and 11. There is something arbitrary about this. We wanted to focus on smaller landlords. The bill specifies that it's a natural person who owns 10 or fewer units, regardless of the mechanism by which they own them. It includes the home of the person, the property owner, if they own that. So the idea was to get at your smaller landlords who have more limited resources and more limited flexibility and more limited ability to negotiate with banks that to restructure their loans. That doesn't mean that we're taking some strong position that banks or taxing authorities should be foreclosing, but this particular bill, the agreement was to protect smaller landlords, and we had to have some definition of that. So I don't think there's anything magic about the number 10.
Your colleagues in the suburbs highlighted the property tax component of this bill. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, we've done a few things with respect to property taxes and mortgages already. In a few months ago, we passed a bill that gives every taxing authority broad flexibility to restructure, reduce, or delay payments of property taxes and any penalties associated with this. That is an option, but not a mandate for localities. This bill basically makes it such that courts will not process and taxing authorities may not file tax cases either for foreclosure or for tax lien sales on a property owner who owns 10 or fewer units if they declare a hardship. And we think that's a significant protection for small landlords and for homeowners throughout the state who might be facing those things. Obviously, property taxes and other local taxes are subject for local governments, and many local governments can and probably should go further than that, but that's the protection this bill offers.
And after a quick break, we'll continue our discussion about sweeping eviction and foreclosure legislation, which our guest, State Senator Brian Kavanaugh, co-authored.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.
We're continuing our discussion with State Senator Brian Kavanaugh, chair of the Chamber's Housing, Construction, and Community Development Committee, and we're discussing legislation that passed on Monday imposing a broad eviction and foreclosure prevention. During the debate on this bill and its subsequent press releases I've seen since it was passed, like one from the AARP, let's talk about the balance that this bill strikes. Can you talk about sort of trying to strike a balance, you know, during the days leading up to Christmas and probably before that as you guys were working on this bill? What are the differing interests that you're trying to balance here?
Yeah, look, I have sponsored a bill previously in the session, and my colleague, Senator Myrie, and Assembly sponsor of this bill, Jeff Dinowitz, and Assembly member Karina Reyes, all have sponsored bills that would have created a complete moratorium on eviction filings. I think that actually would be warranted in this context, but this bill is more subtle and really focuses on the question of whether the respondent in the case is experiencing a hardship. So it is narrower, and that provision is intended to address the notion that many people have expressed that there may just be tenants out there that are taking advantage of the situation, that have the ability to pay, that are not experiencing a hardship, but as long as the courts aren't functioning and evictions can't be filed against them, they are just going to kind of go along and see how long they can last without paying their rent. So the bill specifies that you have to be willing and able to attest that you have a hardship. That is that's a concession to people who are concerned that maybe a blanket moratorium would go a little too far. And at the same time, ensuring that people who have a hardship have the option for relief. So it's a broad bill. We think it's the strongest moratorium on evictions and foreclosures that has been enacted by a legislature anywhere in the country. There are some states with very short-term moratoria that governors have issued through executive order. Minnesota comes to mind. That has to be renewed every few weeks. And this bill, by virtue of being 4 months of protection and having a comprehensive solution from the legislature, we think is a very strong statement. And yet it does ensure that you know, tenants who have the ability to pay, the wealthy tenants that some of my Republican colleagues were talking about on the floor, would be well advised to pay their rent if they have an ability to pay that and not, you know, falsely attest to have a hardship.
Well, then, yeah, like fast forward to the end of this pandemic, hopefully sooner than later. What will happen for tenants who didn't pay their rent during this public health emergency? Are they just going to get a big bill from somebody at the end of the day?
Well, presumably they're getting a bill every month. I mean, tenants are, you know, landlords are attempting to collect their money. They are certainly notifying tenants if they're behind on their rent. There are two, I think that the most basic thing I would like people to understand is that we are doing a moratorium on evictions and foreclosures because that is the best and most important thing we can do at the height of a pandemic. Keep people in their homes. We think that people being involuntarily removed from their homes is dangerous for them. It's also dangerous for the rest of us because evictions and foreclosures that remove people from their homes increase the spread of this deadly disease that we're trying to fight. So I don't think it's a close call whether we should be allowing evictions to go forward at this time. Having said that, the long-term harm of this, the only real way to mitigate that is going to be to find the resources to cover the cost of this rent. And it is a great thing. You know, I began calling in March and April and May for large-scale federal relief that would cover rent and homeowner costs. It is a great thing. It's late, but better late than never, that the Congress passed a bill and the president signed it just Sunday to say that there is rent relief on the way, and we expect that New York State will get $1.3 billion out of that bill. That is not enough to cover the rent, but it might be as much as half or a third of all the unpaid rent in the state. That's a big step forward. We'll obviously need another round of relief if we're going to, you know, dig our way entirely out of this crisis. But the goal of a bill like this is to give, obviously, tenants and homeowners some breathing room so they can be secure in their homes, but it also give us the opportunity to come up with a more comprehensive and thorough solution. And I believe that the most straightforward way is to pay the rent of the people who have been unable to pay their rent during the COVID-19 pandemic.
We saw this summer the legislature come up with a system of administering about $100 million in federal rent relief. With this $1.3 billion, how do you anticipate that money will be distributed in New York? And do you think that the legislature will probably come back in 2021 and come up with a plan similar to what they happened in 2020?
Yeah, I'm very much committed to making sure that that happens. I've been working on a bill with the chair of the Assembly Housing Committee, Assemblymember Simberwitz, which we call the COVID Emergency Rental Assistance Program, which is intended to spend large amounts of federal money. Mm-hmm. We had written the bill when the most likely mechanism for federal money was the bill that was called the HEROES Act that the House of Representatives had passed in Washington, and that would have provided many billions of dollars. It was a $100 billion national program. The bill that was just signed into law is a $25 billion program, and again, we expect to get $1.3 billion. I think this program will be different in many respects than the Emergency Rent Relief Act that we passed because it is much broader, and that bill was by design intended to be quite restrictive because it was such a small amount of money. When you're putting $100 million on the table, it might be 3% of the total need. So it was designed to be restrictive so that the people who got it were among the most needy. I think that, you know, candidly, it seems that some of the restrictions were too narrow and not enough people have qualified. And as a result of that, the governor has amended that program by executive order and reopened the application period. But again, that $100 million is a tiny fraction of what we need. And so I'm less focused on, although we want to get that money out the door, I think it's the real focus ought to be now how to create a much larger scale, more generous program that can cover the real unpaid rent of tenants. That program also, by the way, only goes April through July. So it doesn't cover any rent past July, again, because we had so little money when we passed it. The current federal bill allows you to pay up to 12 months of rent arrears plus 3 months of rent going forward. And I think that is the kind of thing that certainly gets you past May 1st, which is our moratorium. And I think that if we can design that program, and especially if we can do that and then get a second round of stimulus and relief money out of the federal government from the new Biden administration, I think we'll be well on our way to really digging our way out of this crisis, both for landlords and tenants and homeowners.
You talked about sort of the restrictive nature of that first go around of money. One of the things we heard from some of the upstate members was that they, you know, felt excluded largely because the way rents are paid up here, not the size of your income, the way it is in downstate communities. Is that something that you're going to be thinking about when you think about this future pool of money? And what do you think more broadly of those concerns of upstate lawmakers about sort of being excluded from the process?
Yeah, I think it's critical that we ensure that these programs are available throughout the state. I don't read the data as supporting the notion that upstate counties and non-New York City counties were dramatically negatively affected disproportionately by some of the terms of their program. I mean, it is the case that people in New York City and in the surrounding suburbs are likely to be poorer relative to their rent obligations and have a much greater rent burden. So a program that's designed to meet the greatest need probably is well tailored to people with a higher rent burden. And I would also just note that 45% of the entire population of the state lives in New York City, and a higher percentage of New York City residents are renters than the rest of the state. So most renters in the state live in New York City. It's not surprising that a very limited program would go heavily toward residents of the five boroughs. But, you know, people in Westchester and Nassau and Suffolk and many other parts of the state also got rent. And on a per capita basis, it was kind of mixed. There were some upstate counties that seemed to have done pretty well. And again, I don't think that problem is going to be as great a concern if you have a program that is intended to be more generous and intended to cover the real arrears that have piled up for, you know, tenants in all kinds of circumstances, not just the very poor, as that program was designed to do.
Well, we've been speaking with State Senator Brian Kavanaugh. He is chair of the Senate's Housing, Construction, and Community Development Committee and author of new legislation designed to prevent evictions and foreclosures in New York for New Yorkers impacted by the pandemic. Senator, thank you so much for making the time. I really appreciate it.
Same here. It's really a pleasure. Thank you.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by Destiny USA. Shopping, dining, and entertainment all in one location. For more information, go to www.destinyusa.com.